I'm Marissa Levine, Director of Inforum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club, and welcome to tonight's program, Gun Safety is a Winning Issue, with Shannon Watts. Our video, I've seen it a million times. It does not get old. It's a perfect reminder of the amazing programs at Inforum if you come here all the time, and I hope it's an inspiration to buy tickets to something coming up if you're new here tonight. We do like to bring you not just the most interesting speakers, but introduce you to the most interesting people, yourselves. So make a friend and also get ready to ask a question of both Shannon and Robin when we get to that point in the evening. Now, as you may know, the Commonwealth Club hosts more than 400 programs annually, which does not happen without our members, donors, supporters, and other members of our community. We would love to get you involved, so please look for any member of our staff on the way out, and we'd love to help you figure out how. Now, as always, there's an amazing array of programs coming up at Inforum. April 13th, Beyond Prisons, a conversation around criminal justice reform with Cut 50's Van Jones, who you saw in this video, and author Shaka Sengor. April 27th, these go on sale tomorrow, Cocktail Cultures, with the owners of Future Bars, if you've been to Bourbon and Branch. May 4th, we host the Chief Data Scientist of the United States, DJ Patil. May 26th, Jessica Herron, CEO of Stella and Dot. And June 21st, young up-and-coming author Emma Klein and her new book. And we have our youngest member here with us this evening, which I love, by the way. So you can get tickets at commonwealthclub.org. Now, in other fun news, I am giving away some tickets tonight. I love free things. So over on the wooden table here, I've got three lists. Drop your email in. We've got April 4th, our wonderful regular week-to-week political roundtable and social. Come learn something, meet someone, have a glass of wine. April 6th, Income Inequality and the Future of the American Dream. And April 14th, Michael Waldman, Fight the Vote with Judge Ladoris Cordell. Now, a little bit of the nitty-gritty. During our live Q&A, this is your very gentle reminder to please keep your questions, not statements. We like them to end with question marks. We like them to end in about 10 seconds. I'll be standing over there policing that. Also, after tonight's program, we have some students in the audience with us from a school called Minerva, an undergraduate institution here in the city. And they will be hosting a post-program discussion down the hall in our boardroom and would love to invite any of you to join them for that discussion. Now, finally, there's no need to turn off your cell phones. We love social media. My staff will be live tweeting at our handle InforumSF. We do invite you to join us there. However, we are the professional recorders, so our audio and video are the audio and video for the evening. No full recordings of our program. And now, it is my absolute pleasure to introduce tonight's moderator, Robin Thomas, Executive Director of the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence, and our speaker, Shannon Watts, founder of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. Please welcome them to the Inforum stage.
Good evening, and thank you for joining us tonight. I am extremely excited to be here with one of my favorite people doing what is very difficult, challenging, and important work in this country today, Shannon Watts. I first met Shannon a few days after the tragic shooting on December 14th, 2012 at Sandy Hook Elementary School. I know Shannon is the mom of five. At that time, had a daughter in first grade. So the events at Sandy Hook shook me to the core. I know shook Shannon to the core, and that is where our story tonight begins. So I spoke to Shannon because in the days after Sandy Hook, she decided it was time to step into the mix, and we spoke about the issue, and from there, it has snowballed into what is a very, very exciting movement that is building and has been built. So maybe you could start by just talking a little bit about that, those early days and what you did and what happened.
Sure. So I was never politically active in any way except to vote. I was a corporate communications executive for about 15 years. And when my kids got to be about middle school age, I thought, okay, I'm going to stay home. This is when they get into trouble. And so that's what I was doing, minding my own business in suburban Indiana. And then Sandy Hook happened. And I can remember that day I was doing laundry, which is a full-time job with kids. And I saw the news coming in, and I thought, well, this can't be as bad as it seems. This can't be that bad. And it was a million times worse than I ever imagined. And I just thought, you know, I have two choices as an American. I can leave the country, or I can stay and fight. And of course, I had no idea what that meant, stay and fight. But I thought, I know how to start a Facebook page. And I did that, and I was no social media phenom. I had about 75 Facebook friends at the time. And what happened in the hours and days later was stunning. The offers of help, thousands and thousands of emails and calls, women who were pediatricians, women who were web designers, trademark lawyers, all of these offers to help because so many other mothers and women had the same idea that day. We need a Mothers Against Drunk Driving for gun safety. And 3.5 years later, that's what we've become.
At the time when this all began, did you feel like you knew much about the issue, knew what you were getting into? Were you sort of just blindly feeling this urge to do something and didn't worry about
that?
Yeah,
I call myself an accidental activist, mainly because I had no idea about gun laws, not in my state, not in my country. I only knew that I had sat through so many mass shootings and never done anything, and that I felt like our country was broken, particularly when just after Sandy Hook, you turn on the TV and people are calling for more guns, that was somehow the solution. And so, no, I mean, it was like drinking from a fire hose. Day one, learning about the laws, the death threats. Threats of sexual violence started immediately. There was an underbelly to America that I had no idea existed. And yet, I think so many mothers felt that day like, if we lose our children, we have nothing else to lose. So it's time to stand up.
I want to get back a little bit later to the piece about the sort of deeply entrenched antagonism and harsh, aggressive nature of being involved in this debate. But I want to talk first a bit more about what happened in that first year and how the organization has evolved to what it is now. So I remember at the time you were thinly staffed, didn't have much resources. You had thousands of moms kind of pouring in. And when we spoke, you were traveling and trying to figure out what to do with it. And tell me a little bit about in that first year or so, what your experience was. I imagine it was probably overwhelming to try and figure out.
There was a lot of crying on the closet floor. But yeah, I was overwhelmed. I mean, I went from being a stay-at-home mom with a very chill life to, working basically 20 hours a day, and so many other moms in this audience who helped me were doing the same thing. I was a volunteer. I'm still a volunteer. And what we realized was that we needed to quickly organize and capture that momentum after Sandy Hook to keep this in the news, to bridge that intensity gap that so many people had said was the biggest problem in this country. And so, I can remember being on the phone with the CEO of Mothers Against Drunk Driving and just understanding, how do you do this? How do you create chapters? How do you organize online? How do you use social media to your benefit? And it was, we had marches. I think January 26th, we had over a dozen marches across the country that all of these volunteers planned. And that first year was really about continuing the pressure on Congress, and then, as we all know, in April, Congress failed to pass background checks. After that, kind of shifting and pivoting to looking at the states, focusing on businesses, and continuing to grow what was really lightning in a bottle. I mean, the intensity gap is bridged. It has never stopped. The momentum hasn't stopped since day one.
So let's talk a little bit about the corporate strategy, because I think the legislative strategy is a slightly more complicated one. In the United States, we have a state-by-state system. So states have different laws. We know we have quite good, stringent regulation here in California. That is not the case in most other states. And one of the laws that has, I think, come to a lot of public attention is something called open carry. Open carry is a law which enables people to openly carry loaded, not concealed, but openly loaded weapons in public. And in some states where assault weapons are legal, that can include some very scary looking guns. And the moms, I think, in a very interesting approach that acknowledged the role moms play, the protective impulse with our children, tackled that issue head on. And just maybe talk a little bit about what happened and how that went down.
I mean, open carry wasn't something I realized was legal when I started Moms, that you could walk into at the time, a Starbucks, now a Kroger, with a loaded AR-15 or a gun loosely in your pocket, and that in 44 states and now 45, that is perfectly legal. In fact, for open carry, there's very little requirement for background check, training. Even in some states, there's no age requirement. So it's pretty insane. And I can remember about 6 months after Sandy Hook watching the news and seeing that Starbucks was going to ban smoking and electronic cigarettes 25 feet outside its stores, regardless of state law. When I called them, they said they would continue to follow the laws when it came to open carry, which was to allow them inside. And this is happening all over the country. They were having like Starbucks appreciation days. And so we were only 6 months old, and this mighty group of moms started, we do a lot of hashtag activism. We started Skip Starbucks Saturdays. How do you have your coffee with gun sense? Moms showing pictures of themselves going to competitors. And we were able to make images of this open carry go viral. I mean, on one Saturday, I can remember more than 60 people showed up with, they were armed, open carrying in a South Dakota Starbucks, terrifying the customers. I mean, it just became this real flashpoint between moms and gun extremists. Within 3 months, we got the CEO of Starbucks to come out on national television and say guns are no longer welcome in our stores. Pretty amazing for a group of moms, but we make 80% of the spending decisions. So when we go to companies like we have changed policies at Target, Sonic, all of the Brinker restaurants, Chipotle, just recently Trader Joe's, and we're getting ready to make a major announcement tomorrow. So these wins send a very strong cultural signal that this is the direction the country is headed in. You know, if Congress isn't going to protect constituents, companies are going to protect their customers.
I remember, must have been a year or two ago, there was a really well-covered event where some moms were meeting in a diner. What was that, in Texas?
Yes.
In Texas. And an open part of what has happened with the open carry contingent is that as the moms have taken on corporations, people who, gun rights activists who believe in open carry, will show up openly carrying as a statement. And so what happened was you had this visual of moms and large contingents of people openly carrying, which, even though very frightening, and this example comes to mind because the story is that the moms were in the diner and a large contingent of open carrying activists came and were sitting outside the diner with their loaded weapons in sort of formation taking pictures. And the pictures of this event went viral. And I, as scary as it must have been for those moms, and as scary as it is in concept, in some ways I think it was a really powerful image. Was that a moment where you felt like there was a little bit more awareness of what really is going on under the surface?
Yeah, I think two things. One, I believe that moms has put open carry into the American vernacular. And, you know, when you see the extremism and the absurdity of our laws, for example, that you can openly carry if you're blind in the state of Iowa, let that sink in. You know, the absurdity of our country's gun laws. So I think that that was perfectly legal. And by the way, the police were called and they said, we can't do anything because this is illegal. And our moms sat in the restaurant for hours because, you know, these guys are out there with guns. But it happens all the time. So if we have marches with our kids, if we have rallies, you know, we're just trying to exercise our First Amendment, right? And these extremists are using their Second Amendment to really try to intimidate us and silence us and quiet us. I mean, just last month, our moms had a membership meeting in a Kentucky library. Open carry is perfectly legal inside public libraries in Kentucky. 12 armed men showed up, sat in the front row, and our moms put pins on them and took pictures with them and said, if you're going to be here, you might as well listen to what we have to say. So again, I think the days of us being intimidated and silenced and quieted about this issue are over. When 91 Americans are shot and killed every day, we can't be quiet anymore.
Absolutely. So about a year and a half ago, more than that, the moms merged with Michael Bloomberg's organization, now called Everytown. On the one hand, I'm guessing there was a lot of big pluses to that decision, resources and support systems and staffing. On the other hand, I would guess, you know, grassroots movements are organic and messy and complicated and bottom up, and merging with an organization that's much more structural, structured and top down. You know, I'm sort of curious how that plays out, what the challenges are, what the complexities of that decision.
Yeah, about a year in, I realized we were going to need to partner with another organization that brought us financial, human, political, legal resources, that we had the grassroots army, but we needed some generals who could help kind of make us strategic and make sure we won. And, you know, I interviewed organizations inside and outside the space, and ultimately what was then Mayors Against Illegal Guns had the most similar ideas about doing this, mainly going into the states and fighting and changing corporate policy. Many of them worked on marriage equality, and that was sort of the same strategy. To be honest, you know, I come from a long line of Fortune 100 companies. That was my career, like General Electric, and everything was top down. And I think we did a very good job from the beginning of having consistent messaging, of having consistent brand. And, you know, when mayors met us, they said, "You seem like an organization that's been around for a decade," and we were only a year old. That said, there was some autonomy that first year, right? So we had different chapters doing different things that were important to them in their communities or states, but in retrospect, they weren't necessarily the most strategic thing. So now we have the ability to say, okay, what is strategic policy-wise, legally, and that's going on with legislation in your state, but also there's that back and forth of the chapter saying, here's what's important to us in our state, here's what we're really passionate about, and making room for that too.
So there's some flexibility in responding to that. I want to talk about kids and guns. You know, I think your passion and some of my passion comes from concern that this is an issue that affects children. There's 1.7 million American children living in homes with unsecured, loaded firearms. 1.7 million children. You know, a child in America is 16 times more likely to be killed with a firearm than in any other country in the world. And so the question of how to address that specific problem in some ways is complicated. In other ways, there's legislation and approaches that are policy driven, and then there's a cultural norm. And I know that you all have been looking at that issue and coming up with ways to bring it into the conversation. So maybe tell us about that effort.
Yeah, I mean, do you guys know of any other developed nation where children are shooting their mothers by accident, or as we say, unintentionally? It's absolutely a moral travesty. And, you know, I think it's incumbent upon us to prevent that from happening. I think it's much like the 1980s. So if you're alive in the 1980s, you remember that someone would get in their car and they would drive drunk and they would kill their family, and people would say, "Oh, what a tragedy. That person has suffered enough. We can't punish them. We can't possibly charge them with anything." Then Mothers Against Drunk Driving came along and said, "Well, wait a minute. You know, laws are the moral underpinning of our society. We have to have laws in place so this doesn't keep happening." And that's kind of where we are right now. We're like the 1980s, but for guns. So if I leave my gun on the kitchen counter loaded and a five-year-old gets it and shoots themselves or someone else, people would say, "Oh, what a horrible tragedy. That woman has suffered enough. We can't possibly punish her." The majority of laws around child access prevention in this country are mainly misdemeanors. And you know a lot about
this. If there's even laws at all, which
right.
Most states don't even have.
Right. So you get fined $200, right, if your child shoots themselves and kills themselves with your loaded gun. And in my mind, that isn't an accident. That's negligence. And so we have worked on, you know, this should not be a polarizing issue, whether or not you should store your gun responsibly. Gun owners and non-gun owners alike should agree that you should keep your guns locked, unloaded, separate from ammunition. And so that's what Be Smart does, besmartforkids.org, if you want to learn more about it. We've done more than 500 presentations. We've partnered with the PTA. And, you know, I think the next step in that is how do we strengthen these laws in the states so that there is some kind of repercussion.
Yeah, and I would just add that, you know, there's CAP laws, child access prevention laws, which have to do with liability. And then there are safe storage laws, which are exactly what they sound like. And in fact, here in San Francisco, we have one of the strongest safe storage laws anywhere in the country. And research has shown that 70% of accidents or unintentional shootings of children could be prevented if people safely stored their firearms. So that's significant. And there are hundreds of deaths of children every year from
suicides and unintentional shootings and kids who get their parents' guns and bring them and commit mass shootings. And it's 100% preventable.
Absolutely. So is the campaign an educational campaign to create awareness about safe storage? Is it dovetail at all with the Ask campaign for parents to ask about guns in the home of where their children play?
It does. The A in the SMART stands for ask, and it is important to ask. The Brady campaign also has a program teaching people, you know, when you go to someone's house, your kids are going to have a play date. It's not a fun conversation, especially outside of California. You know, do you have guns in your home and how do you store them? But what we have found is that kids actually are getting most of the guns at their own homes and in their own cars. And so it's also about women being comfortable having conversations with their husbands if they're gun owners. But ultimately, it's a conversation that has to happen. Last night, I had a conversation with a woman who said, I'm not comfortable asking, but I have taught my kids that you never touch a gun. But data shows that your child is going to touch that gun, no matter how many times you've told them to, especially boys. There is an innate curiosity. And the onus, this is what makes me so angry about the NRA's Eddie Eagle program, right? Sort of the Joe Camel of guns. It's a marketing program. And the onus is not on children to keep them safe from loaded weapons. The onus is on us as adults always. And I think that's such an important cultural message.
I want to talk a little bit about the harassment. And this is sort of a tricky part of it for me because, you know, we certainly similarly get the threats and often violent threats, and we have security measures because we have safety concerns. And I know from my conversations with you that what you've experienced in that regard is in some ways far worse, more personal threats of sexual violence. And it's disturbing for me to see what's coming at you. So I'm just sort of curious how that feels and why you think that happens and how you handle it.
Yeah, that has been the most interesting part of this. And not obviously just myself, but moms all across the country who are fighting this fight. You know, I think it's a few things. One, I think the gun lobby has done a good job of terrifying a vocal minority that their rights or their guns are going to be taken away, which isn't the case. To be clear, we support the Second Amendment. Many of our moms are gun owners. But there's this vocal minority that lives in fear, right? I mean, that's why they're bringing their guns to the grocery store. And, you know, I think the other piece of it is anytime you have cultural change in this country, you are going to have people who are angry, and you are going to have people who go after you. Now, the difference is our opposition is armed, so it makes it slightly different. But, you know, it's a form of intimidation. And, you know, I think that I speak for myself and a lot of our moms volunteers in saying that, you know, we're just not going to be intimidated. Women have a right to talk about this issue. 53 women are shot and killed by intimate partners every single month. This is a women's issue. We should have a seat at the table in making our laws, which obviously we're the minority in Congress and state legislatures. So this is how we're going to do it. We're going to use it by using our votes, using our voices, using the way we spend our dollars. And that's how we're going to affect change.
Are you ever scared?
You know, for the most part, no. I mean, I'll admit, when I come to public events like this, absolutely. You know, it's shameful that I have to have security when all I want are common sense laws like background checks on every gun sale. But, you know, that's kind of the environment in this country, is that when you are a woman, often, and you use your voice on an issue, that you're going to get pushback.
So, after Newtown, the Senate took up the question of universal background checks in April of 2013. There were hearings. The Senate Judiciary Committee voted on putting background check legislation, which would close what is a giant gaping hole, which allows for private sales of firearms to be transferred without background checks. That legislation failed to pass out of the Senate. It had about 55 votes, but with cloture rules, they needed 60 in order for it to get to the House, and they failed. And I think a lot of Americans saw that vote, and they thought that, first of all, that was the end of the story, and that there was no progress that was going to be made, and we were going to fail. And because we do most of our work at the state level, that year, the year after Newtown, we normally work with 3, 4, 5, 8 states in a given year. That year, we got requests from 30 states to introduce new legislation, and were able to pass dozens of new laws in that year after Newtown. And that momentum has continued. Since Newtown, we've seen 125 new laws passed in 41 states. And so, you know, we certainly, my organization has a strategy for state legislative reform, and I know you all have strategy, and I'm wondering what your plans are. What issues besides background checks, do you have other issues that are priorities, domestic violence, mental health? Where do you see the mom's role in bringing change legislatively?
Well, a lot of it is just having boots on the ground, which is not something we've really had in the past, right? So the fact that we have a chapter in every single state of the country, we're able to go in and fill the Senate Night Gallery. You see a lot of our moms here. This is what they wear when they show up. And in many ways, they outnumber the extremists in the gun lobby so much that they have to stand in a holding room. And to have that ability to activate a grassroots network when the NRA has been able to sort of flip a switch and generate calls and emails and lawmaker meetings, we can do that now. And lawmakers know that women vote. We're, in many ways, the majority of the voting electorate, depending on the election. So that has been incredibly powerful. As you know, last year, we helped defeat 64 bad bills that the NRA supported. They called their own legislative agenda a train wreck in an internal memo last year. And so, yay, train wreck. That is one way to win, right? Just showing up and saying, not in my community, not in my state, no way. You are not going to dismantle the permit system or allow guns on campus or put guns in K-12 schools, essentially creating a marketing plan to sell guns to our children. But we're also playing offense. So, as you know, we went into Washington in 2014. We had tried to pass background checks there in the years before. The state legislature didn't do that. So we initiated a ballot initiative. These are really expensive. These are millions of dollars, and the NRA's never had this kind of opposition before where someone could go in and do that. And we were able to use our boots on the ground to collect signatures for the ballot, educate people about what the initiative was, get people out to vote, and we won by 60% in Washington State. And that is not just a blue state, that's a red state too.
That was the first time ever that a ballot initiative was used as a tool to circumvent legislative inaction.
And we're getting ready to do the exact same thing in Nevada and in Maine in November. The reason that's important to California is because I think it's the second most amount of crime guns come from Nevada to California. So you guys are only as safe as your neighboring state with the weakest gun laws. And so that's a ballot initiative strategy. We also have been able to go through the state legislatures and pass background checks like in Oregon. But then in more than a dozen states, we've helped pass laws to keep guns out of the hands of domestic abusers. You would think that would be the law. No. The gun lobby has fought for years to let domestic abusers have guns. The definition of what a domestic abuser is incredibly narrow. It doesn't include dating partners or stalkers, for example. So that is something that the NRA has essentially given up on. It's not a winning issue to keep guns in the hands of domestic abusers.
That's been a really exciting trend that we've been really excited to be working on, because there's been, I think, 19 laws in 21 states in the last 2 years in domestic violence. So it seems like there are certain issues that are really moving fast.
And signed into law by Republican governors.
Yeah, in Louisiana. So that, and Wisconsin and other states. So that's been really exciting. So would you say that's the focus of your strategy, background checks, domestic violence?
It is. I mean, when we're not playing defense, we're on offense on passing those laws. But, to be clear, passing background checks would be so significant. When you pass a background check, the 18 states that have passed them, we see the amount of police killings, the amount of domestic homicides with guns, gun trafficking, mass shootings. We see all of these decreased almost by half. We know they work. When you look at a state like Missouri that had good gun laws and then undid them all, you see homicides and suicides by gun spike.
Instantly. Yeah.
So these laws work, and how incredibly morally bankrupt is it for lawmakers to not pass this simple law that would close a loophole that would save lives? I mean, 33,000 Americans are shot and killed in this country every single year. Can you imagine if anything else was killing that amount of Americans that they wouldn't act?
Sort of to dovetail into that, I want to talk to you a little bit about the NRA and what the truth is. I think one of the things I have found so interesting over time in my own knowledge and also in my conversations with people is what the perception of the NRA is and sort of what the reality is, because it's amazing how far apart those two things are.
Yes.
The perception of what they stand for, what their members believe, who they represent. They purport to represent gun owners when they represent a very, very tiny minority. I think we could probably spend a lot of time talking about this, but just a little bit in what your experience of not only working in opposition to the NRA and taking a little bit of a page from their playbook, but also what your sense is of the truth of what they stand for.
I mean, I think it's a case of a lobby just operating unchecked for decades, and they have amassed this sense of power, particularly among lawmakers, right? So lawmakers feel beholden to them. I think a great example that shocked me was right after background checks failed, Heidi Heitkamp, a Democrat in North Dakota, U.S. Senator, whose constituents overwhelmingly supported closing the background check loophole, said she didn't vote for it because she got more calls from the other side. But what that really meant was that she was scared of the NRA. And they, you know, have built up this alleged power, but when they're really a paper tiger. I mean, when you look at the investments they've made in elections, they're not doing well. The majority of their money comes from gun manufacturers, and they have to rely on fear and creating this sense of chaos in order to sell guns. I mean, Barack Obama has been a great gun salesman for them because they're able to sort of prey on people's fears. We have seen them not really know how to deal with state opposition and not really know what to do. But that said, if you look at Colorado, I think is a good example. Governor Hickenlooper signed into law some sweeping gun legislation after Aurora. And what the NRA did was come in an off-cycle election, recall two lawmakers successfully, kind of to send a chilling signal to all the other lawmakers, like, look out. You know, if you vote the wrong way, this is what we're going to do. And we're like, ugh. Okay, so how are we going to...
So frustrating. Outcome.
Yeah, because they were like, look at us, you know? And so at the midterm elections, what we did was go in and replace those two lawmakers who filled the seats of who was recalled, in fact, one with our own staff member. And then when we went into Oregon and passed background checks, we thought, okay, we better stay in the state. We better stay here because they are going to come after these lawmakers. And sure enough, they tried to recall four lawmakers, and we stopped every single one from getting recalled.
Good lesson.
It's chess, yeah. You know, it's chess in many ways.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, going forward, particularly in purple states and red states, which is where these victories can be so exciting, there is a chess game that's happening. And, you know, you have to be one step ahead of them.
Yeah.
I would just add in talking about the NRA that understanding this very, very, very small number of people that the NRA's leadership actually speaks for. You know, if there's 4 million NRA members out of 80 million gun owners in America, that's a very tiny portion of even gun owners. And then even when they poll NRA members, 70-80% of NRA members support things like background checks. So you have this leadership that represents maybe a million gun owners at most who is dominating the political process, which is one of the reasons why the moms movement is so exciting, because the NRA leadership relies upon those million single issue voters to leverage a lot of power. And that power can easily be, I think, balanced out if we had some opposition on the other side.
Right. And speaking of that, I mean, Hillary Clinton said on Tuesday that this should be the number one voting issue in the upcoming election. I mean, what
talk about a sea change. Presidential.
Right. So in 2008 and 2012, you couldn't get Democrats or Republicans alike to talk about guns. In fact, Hillary spent a lot of time talking about how her parents were duck hunters, right? So the whole thing was all about, you know, guns are a third rail. Let's try not to talk about that. Flash forward to 2016. I mean, they can't stop talking about it. They're fighting to see who is the strongest on this issue. And frankly, I think a lot of that is that we have been so successful in showing that we will have lawmakers' backs if they do the right thing, and that this is an important issue. I mean, I'm a single issue voter, and you know, I appreciate that people don't necessarily approve of that. But how can I be worried about education and healthcare and things like that when I don't know that my kids are going to come home from school alive? That is my issue, and that's what I'm going to vote on. And you know, the fact that people are talking about it in this election, that I think it'll be an issue in the general election. It's the perfect wedge issue. And I just think that because moms are on the ground, I mean, every event we go to, and we go to Republican and Democrat events to keep this on the agenda.
Do you go to Trump rallies?
We do. Yes, we do. We don't make it in, but we're outside. With our gear.
Because you're
on.
Wearing your shirts.
Yes, we have our shirts on outside. But you know, I think, you know, moms were one of the first people to ask Bernie Sanders why he supported, you know, immunity for gun manufacturers in a public forum. So we are at every event to keep this issue on the agenda.
And do you see it as something, how do you see what the shift has been in the political arena? Do you think that that momentum is continuing sort of through this presidential politics as a reflection of the presidential politics? Is it something that is a priority for the moms to focus on the electoral strategy?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think you'll see us doing a lot of voter registration in the lead up. In the midterm elections, we signed up more than 1 million people to be what we call gun sense voters. This idea of, do you know if your candidate has an A rating from the NRA? And by the way, if they do, that means they probably support guns for domestic abusers. They support guns for suspected terrorists. They do not support closing the background check loophole. So a lot of this is education, because it is amazing how little people know about gun laws. I mean, we were talking about where gun owners stand. You know, a lot of people don't even realize there is a background check loophole. So educating people as they go in to vote about why this issue is so important. And unfortunately, because we live in a country where there is so much gun violence, not a day goes by where people don't have a reminder of how important this issue is. And, you know, I work a lot with survivors. Did not know anyone impacted by gun violence before I started Moms. And Richard Martinez here from California, whose son was shot and killed in the UCSB shooting, who started Not One More, and worked with us to pass the red flag law here in the state of California, he said to me, through tears, if only I had gotten involved after Sandy Hook, maybe my son wouldn't have been shot and killed. And I think that so many people see so many shootings now in this country that that is this feeling like, if I don't act, it could be my family, it could be my community. And people need to use that fear or that concern to get involved and to get active and to really think about this when they go into the voting booth.
117,000 Americans were shot last year. That's the last number I heard, 117,000. And it's always occurred to me that with 117,000 people shot, the ripple of family members and friends and communities that are touched by gun violence is just simply staggering. And I've sort of wondered, why isn't there more of a groundswell to fight on this issue when you have so many people directly impacted? And I don't know if that's because the people who are touched by gun violence, their lives are so devastated by it that fighting for legislation is maybe the last thing that they're able to do. But I've noticed part of the movement with the Survivors Network has been the parents. It seems to be parents, moms, but dads also, like yep. Richard, who nothing can stop them. They're not afraid of the gun lobby. They're mm-hmm. not afraid. No threat to them is worse than the experience they've had of losing a child. Do you have a lot of survivor parents in your networks? Do they play a sort of more prominent role? Is it challenging to do that work?
We do, and it is challenging to do that work. I think they want to tell their stories, and the wonderful thing about working with Moms Demand Action is that we do a lot of training. So we train survivors to give testimony. We train moms to give testimony, to be advocates, to be activists. But when your life has been literally blown apart by gun violence, you know, there's sort of, you're discombobulated by this grief. And I, when you talk about why don't people get necessarily involved, or why isn't this groundswell, I mean, I can remember thinking after Gabby Giffords was shot, well, surely Congress will, you know, come in around their own and do something. And, you know, people shouldn't wait. And I think that's why it's so important that everyone get involved and everyone play a role, because this is entirely preventable, and we can actually save lives. And I know that we have saved so many lives through our movement, but we just need all voices on this. And some of it may be that people have been sort of chilled by the gun lobby or by thinking this issue won't affect them, but hopefully we can dispel that.
Yeah, by the time it touches you, it's far too late.
Yes.
Does your organization prioritize collaborating and working closely with other groups on the ground? Is that something that's important, or is it more important to sort of stick with the strategy and be firm in your mission, or is there a sense of flexibility around sort of the larger context?
No, we do. And as you know, there are several gun violence prevention organizations. I think we work pretty well together. There's a weekly call where we all coordinate. We fill in and play different roles depending on what it is. For example, when we were working on the Washington ballot initiative, Gabby Giffords and her husband, Mark Kelly, were sort of deployed, you know, you guys go talk to the gun owners, and different groups play different roles. So when you look at marriage equality, you know, there were different groups. There were right flanks and left flanks and other groups doing things. And so I think what the most important thing is that they're coordinated.
Yeah, I think the marriage equality example is an excellent one, because there was a very coordinated, concerted strategy there. I think from the outside, the perception was that things happened quickly. But if you're paying attention, you actually know that it was many decades of very careful coordination to bring us to the point where you had an opportunity for cultural change and, yeah. and legislative change. So I think for those of us doing this work, there's a sense that that tipping point may not be that far off if it's not already been reached.
Well, and that's the takeaway I hope everyone has. We are winning. You know, I'm a volunteer. I wouldn't wake up and spend 12 hours every day, 7 days a week working on this if we weren't winning. And the gun lobby wants you to think we aren't winning and we can't win. And that isn't the reality. I mean, there has been such a sea change in this movement since Sandy Hook. And it is just years away. I mean, it is a marathon. It is not a sprint. It's going to be several election cycles. But this is, you know, this room here, this is no different than when people got together and talked about suffrage or civil rights, child labor laws. These are the people on the ground that are going to change it and save lives.
You've been doing a lot of traveling. I see you in all kinds of places that are not here. When you're traveling, what is it that you're out there doing? You are meeting one-on-one with people, you're holding parties. What is your message? What are you asking people to do?
To get involved. To tell them we're winning. You know, I've been here for 3 days now, and we had a great house party in Palo Alto. Over 50 people, many of them new members who are excited and energized and getting into this issue and how they can help us in Nevada, for example. And just speaking, and this is all about bridging that intensity gap and making sure that this issue doesn't leave anyone's mind, that it stays on the agenda, that it stays top of mind, and that people are voting on it and that they're thinking about it, that it becomes as much a part of the discussion as every other issue, and that when there's a mass shooting, it isn't a spike in interest, and then all of a sudden the issue goes away and drops off the radar. You know, I think it's media malpractice when the media kind of reports that this is hopeless or this isn't, you know, going to happen. I mean, those are NRA talking points. The reality is when you look at what wins we're having in the states, when you look at the corporate change that we've affected in just 3 years, my kids think marriage equality happened overnight. It didn't. It was years and years of activism, and we have that now under our belts across the board through all these organizations, and so I really feel like it's a matter of time.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. I think that comment that there's been a sea change is right on, and because, you know, I've been in this job for 10 years, so in the years leading up to Newtown, any small victory was a huge accomplishment. And in the year since Newtown, we have far more work than we can manage because the requests coming in from state legislatures and ballot initiatives and everything that's happening has just absolutely exploded yep. in the last few years. And that's really exciting. It's challenging. And on the upside, we're winning in a lot of states. On the downside, there is definitely a pendulum swing in more conservative states. And that's where the defensive battles are being fought. Maybe speaks to the fact that sometimes we're winning and sometimes we're not.
But a great example is just last week in Florida, the legislative session ended there. This is Florida is basically the petri dish for the NRA. And we were able to go in and be on defense, and we defeated campus carry. We defeated dismantling the permit system, and we defeated, what was the other one? What? Stand your ground. They wanted to make that even more horrendous. So those three bills we were able to defeat just by showing up every day and investing and getting the word out and educating people about how dangerous those bills were.
I remember someone telling me a couple of years ago about a strategy the moms had called a stroller jam. And I love this idea because it was the moms showing up at the Capitol building with strollers with their kids and literally jamming the halls of the Capitol building because legislators wouldn't meet with them, wouldn't stop to talk to them, wouldn't listen to what they had to say. And so they took their strollers and they jammed it up. And I love the idea of this image of moms with strollers in the halls of the Capitol and basically pressing their point in a very visual way. Are you still doing those?
We are, yeah. And our very smart trademark lawyer trademarked those, by the way. But we've had stroller jams all over from public transportation to the Capitol to state houses. And we really do try to make this activism friendly. You know, in some ways it's intimidating to get on the phone and call your member of Congress. I had never done it. And I can remember one of our moms put her baby down for a nap and made a video. And this is how you call your member of Congress. And I mean, that video went viral because people were like, oh, wow, okay, I can do that too. And this is what it looks like. And that's pretty simple. And this is when I can do it during the day. We've done a lot of crafts, you know, to get moms involved in their kids and to show kind of what they've done. We made Valentines for lawmakers and delivered them in mass. Things that are emotional and that hopefully touch lawmakers, but also touch the mothers who are doing them. And, you know, some people deride hashtag activism. It has been an amazing boon for us. I mean, you know, moms are busy. They have jobs or they're stay-at-home moms and they're busy. But to get on Twitter and start telling Chipotle burritos, not bullets, you know, that worked in a weekend. We got Chipotle to change their stance on guns. And it was because of what we were able to do online. And, you know, I don't know how Mothers Against Drunk Driving did it without Facebook. I mean, it's just, you know, they must have been like driving places and making calls and delivering letters. But, you know, for us, Facebook is such an important way to connect. It's such an important way to organize. And then Twitter is such an important way to lobby both companies and lawmakers. And they're tools that moms used anyway. And we've just turned them into ways to save lives.
Because I think it's a nice shout out, what are the corporations that have stepped up and changed their policies in response to your efforts?
We have a whole list of them at momsdemandaction.org. I'll try to remember them, but Target.
That's a good one.
Target was great, and that took a little while, but they came around. Starbucks, Chipotle, Sonic, all of the Brinker restaurants, Trader Joe's, Facebook and Instagram.
Stop selling guns on their website.
Yeah, so Facebook is an interesting story because we started on Facebook, mm-hmm. and within months we said to Facebook, you are becoming a huge platform for private sales and transfers, and it's incredibly dangerous. I mean, we were able to show where domestic abusers were getting guns and minors were getting guns from Facebook. They, a few months later, put 9 policies in place to kind of keep kids from seeing guns or to make sure people knew the laws in their state around background checks, which was great, and we applauded them. But we kept talking to them for 2 years. And we showed them research that showed how guns were getting in the hands of dangerous people through Facebook. They came out last month and said no more private gun transfers or sales on our platform. That's a huge cultural signal. We know that lawmakers are impacted by what major businesses do. In fact, when Chipotle changed their policies, the first question that then Governor Rick Perry got on CNBC the other day was what he thought about this change in policy.
And what did he say?
He said he was not a fan of open carry, that you should have your gun hidden so you could take people off guard. I'll take that for what you will. But as long as you don't support open carry, that's fine. But
wow. Just a little bit personally, partly, you know, I'm always curious I ask myself, how do you sustain working on an issue like this that is so painful sometimes and draining and emotionally taxing? And it's hard. Yeah. I mean, partially you have to work with people that inspire you and you have to have victories. And you're even more, I think, because you're working with survivors. I'm mostly in the policy wonky arena, but how do you handle it? How do you sustain sort of positivity and optimism when you're dealing with survivors and when you're dealing with, horrific threats? Yeah. You know, what's your personal approach?
You know, I think it's what you said before. I mean, it's the connection with others. I said I had 75 Facebook friends when I started this. I now have like thousands and thousands of Facebook friends.
I was just going to say many thousands.
Yes. And so when there is a tragedy, we do reach out to each other and say, you know, this solidifies our commitment to this issue. But it is very easy. You know, one of my daughters said, how do you wake up every morning to a horrific shooting? You know, that just can't feel good. But at the same time, it's such an incredible honor to do this work. You know, I feel like I've touched the divine over the last 3 years, that I have been allowed to do something with such purpose and such meaning, so much different than, you know, selling widgets when I was at General Electric. And so I'm incredibly honored to work with the survivors and to work with all of these amazing moms who are volunteers who, you know, they say, if you want something done, give it to a busy mom. These women have carved somehow like 40 hours of a work week out of their already busy schedules. And so I think it's been a real team effort, and it has felt like lightning in a bottle. We all get together once every year, and we, because of Facebook, all feel like we know each other and each other's families. And it's just become an amazing network.
I when I'm feeling blue, I think about my kids, because if I'm able to leave them a safer world than what we have right now, then it will have been worth it. And, you know, I think that's what Newtown did for me. It was a reminder of what's at stake. You know, what always upsets me or worries me is that people don't care about this issue until it touches them. And for most people who don't live in impacted communities or who don't have it in their lives, they can't imagine it. It's not something people want to think about. And so they don't want to get involved, because thinking about something like gun violence and the impact it has is hard for people to reconcile with their daily lives. And I think when you work on this issue and you're constantly reading the stories and working with people who are touched by it, you can't help but demand that it be different than what it is right now. And I'm supposed to say right now that in 5 minutes, we're going to take questions. There's a mic on your far right. So if you want to ask questions, you can go and line up behind that mic. And I want to reiterate, it has to be a question. It's not that we don't want to hear what you're feeling and thinking. We do, just not right now. So keep it to a question for Shannon or I. And if you're rambling on too much, I apologize in advance for cutting you off and directing you to a question. But we're going to wind up here in a minute, and then we'll go to the audience.
But I would just add to what you were saying about our children. You know, I think there's a real risk that this next generation of millennials are going to be very angry. They're going to be very angry that we subjected to them to things like lockdown drills, as though they were acts of nature, when they're really acts of cowardice. Our children are having to hide under their desks to practice for dying because we haven't acted. And I think there will be a real anger and resentment there that we did nothing. And so, you know, that I think about that too, that I have this moral obligation to act because what is happening is preventable.
Absolutely. Before we go to the questions, is there anything having to do with your own personal perspective, your experiences on this, or what the moms are doing that you just sort of want to speak about briefly in case we don't get to
I would just,
questions.
You know, make this a plea to get involved. We have moms members here. Can you guys raise your hands? You can go to any of them and ask how to get involved. And because they're moms, they all brought clipboards to sign you up. And, you know, it is as easy as just joining us and making calls or sending tweets or emails, but it's also as big as finding what you're passionate about. We've talked a lot of stuff that moms do. And again, all men are welcome as well. My favorite thing is to see men wearing moms t-shirts. Not One Tough Mother, that's weird, but the Moms Demand Action t-shirts. And just to get involved and to even think about, you know, leadership positions or how you want to get involved. But it really will make a difference, particularly, again, remembering that we have this ballot initiative coming up in Nevada, and it absolutely impacts all of you.
I would just add to that that for many years we've been testifying in California. And in California, we've been privileged enough to have a ton of success. We have a lot of political will and legislative champions here. But even in California, when we would go and testify in Sacramento, we would be outnumbered. Thankfully, it didn't necessarily change the balance in the outcome, but it certainly was not an incredibly pleasant experience. And just in the last year or two, that's not the case anymore. When we go to Sacramento now, the moms show up, and they, at the very least, give us a sense that we are not out there alone. I can't tell you how many legislative hearings I've testified at, and I've been the only person, or with one other, you know, not happy staffer from my team, to be there, because there would be 50 aggressive gun rights activists who are not afraid to be intimidating and to try and make us feel uncomfortable. And it's just in the last year or two that that has shifted. And when I go to these hearings to testify, I'm not alone. And that's been really just, you know, a really wonderful experience, even for us here in California, where you would think maybe that wasn't the case. But in fact, it's even in places where you have political will, getting off the couch and showing up and standing up for an issue that is contentious, even just talking about this issue publicly with your friends in San Francisco can be tricky, because it is an issue that is passionate for people and it's personal, and it makes it something that requires, you know, I think a firm constitution.
If our moms in Mississippi and Texas can do it, moms in California can do it for sure.
Exactly. Okay, so
We're going to go to the questions and to you.
I am just standing up here to thank you for all you're doing for safety for our children and all of us. Thank you so much.
It was a total softball.
Thank you for that. That was tough. Someone usher that extremist out of here.
Do you plant her in the audience?
And I'm here to say ditto. my wife and I have a daughter-in-law who's from Newtown. And before she married my son, we had an opportunity to visit Newtown. And for those people who think that it can't happen in my town, it can.
Yes.
Newtown is about as close to a Norman Rockwell painting as you can get.
Yes.
And my wife and I were shocked on December 14th, which was a week after my son married our daughter-in-law. And we joined the Sandy Hook Promise, which was formed by a group of parents who lost kids. And thank you for all you're doing.
Thank you very much.
Hey, Shannon, good on you for what you're doing. My understanding is that the mothers are all about saving lives, courage in our children. Here in California, you know, we have an initiative, Safety for All, that would go for all of that, and you guys aren't supporting that. Why not?
Well, so when I talked about Nevada and Maine, those are where our resources were focused before. You're talking about the Gavin Newsom ballot initiative. We are thrilled when lawmakers take action on this anywhere in the country. I mean, this is an incredibly creative way to go at it, and that is wonderful. Our resources are focused on background checks, and they're focused this year in Nevada and Maine. But, you know, we absolutely applaud him for what he's working on.
Thank you.
Explain to the audience what your perception of Gavin's proposal is.
Well, you know, I think Robin can give a good background on what it's about.
So the Safety for All ballot initiative that's been introduced here has five different parts, mostly focused on ammunition background checks, which is an extremely groundbreaking, first of its kind anywhere in the country approach, relinquishment of firearms from people who become prohibited from having them, requiring lost and stolen reporting of firearms, which is proven to prevent trafficking, and a couple of other sort of slightly less easy to understand provisions. And I think what's exciting for us about the ballot initiative is that California has been a leader on this issue for decades and really stands apart from any other state in the country in terms of the willingness to take on this issue without fear of repercussions that you might face elsewhere. And as a result of California's work and success, and a 60% reduction in gun deaths in California in the last 20 years as a result in part of those measures, there's a lot of excitement that this is our opportunity to now step into the lead again, to really take this issue on proactively and say, okay, we've done a lot in California. A lot of states have followed suit in the years since Newtown, New York and Connecticut and other states followed California's lead. Let's start leading again. Let's take this up and look at what is the next frontier of gun violence prevention so we can have safer communities, so that we can show what is possible. And so it's really exciting. You can go to safetyforall.com. You can find out more about it. The petitions, they have 400,000 signatures now, so they're going to get to about 500,000 shortly. So anything you can do to support that, I think, would be amazing.
Good evening. Thank you for all you do. My question is more about the impact on international communities that are working on these issues. After the Belgian terrorist attack, there was a quote from an ER doctor who worked in either Paris or Belgium who said, our biggest challenge right now is we've never seen gunshot wounds in the ER.
Hmm.
And so I found that pleasantly surprising, but also shocking. So I'm just wondering if you, I mean, I know we have the Second Amendment here, and it's a very different culture in America, but are you working with other countries on, you know, learning things from their experiences?
We are focused mainly on the United States, but, you know, you bring up terrorism, which is interesting because in this country, we spend a lot of time talking about terrorism and fighting terrorism. When you look at the deaths caused by terrorism of Americans, about less than 300 in the last 20 years. as opposed to hundreds of thousands of deaths caused by gun violence. And so, you know, and yet you also have the gun lobby fighting to keep guns in the hands of suspected terrorists. I don't know if you guys all saw that, but right after the most recent bout of terrorism, the NRA came out and said, you can't take away someone's constitutional right to own a gun, even if they're a suspected terrorist. And many lawmakers actually supported them, which is sort of an absurd idea that you cannot board an airplane, but yes, you can go buy an AK-47. So, you know, our focus is mainly on the United States, but I think terrorism is an interesting subject when you talk about what is the messaging for the gun lobby. And I don't know if you have any thoughts on the international piece.
I love to tell the story of Australia because it's a great story. So Australia had a similar gun ownership reality to ours, similar type of gun regulation. And in 1996, there was a mass shooting in Port Arthur. And following the mass shooting at Port Arthur, John Howard, who was the prime minister, stepped up and pushed through really comprehensive gun reform, gun policy reform, including not only banning assault weapons, but a buyback of all assault weapons in private hands in Australia. And it was not popularly appreciated at the time. He really had to push hard to get it through, and he did it. And he took back about 600,000 assault weapons that were in private hands at the time. And Australia certainly still does have gun violence. It has not been eliminated. But since 1996, there has not been one mass shooting in Australia. Not one. And there were, I think, 13 in the decade before Port Arthur, serious mass shootings. So the story of Australia is one where people talk in this country about how many guns are in private hands, about the culture of gun ownership in this country, about political will. And this is an example of political will from the top. And this was a conservative prime minister who tackled the issue head on, did what he had to do. There is still private gun ownership in Australia, but it is a totally different type of regulation now. People still have guns, they're licensed, they're registered, there's no assault weapons, and there have been no mass shootings. So there are international examples that are really powerful. That's my favorite story. So. Yeah.
So I have a comment and a question. My comment is, I liked you on Facebook a couple days after the Newton Town shooting, and I like you even more in person. But I'm wondering why you don't have more of the things you mentioned, like the politicians' rating and how people could get more involved rather than just heartbreaking story after heartbreaking story. I would like to see more of that. So that's just a comment,
sure. And
not really a question.
If you get involved with the California chapter and, you know, kind of work with them, you will find that they absolutely do that. I mean, our moms were out across the country at the midterm elections, showing up at lawmakers' offices saying, explain your A. Show up with our strollers, hang out for hours until they would come out and say, why do you have an A rating? So, we also make endorsements and get involved in political elections.
Okay, I guess maybe I've just missed it on
yep.
Facebook. And here's a question that I'm kind of afraid of the answer. I have a teenage son. How do you feel these awful shooter up, terrible, miserable, horrible shooter computer games might add to
the... She has an opinion.
Excuse me?
No, I said you have an opinion
about
that.
Yeah, I do. How do you feel they might add to desensitizing, unfortunately, and maybe this is sexist, more young men and boys to shooting?
It is a great question. I don't think we know the answer. You know, the reality is that we play the same video games, we watch the same movies as other developed nations. The only reason that we have so much gun violence is because of the way we regulate or don't regulate the guns in this country. The other fun thing about the gun lobby is that they have completely been able to put a chill on research in this country. So basically, they've taken away dollars so we can figure out how big is our problem and what causes it and how do we solve it. So I think it's an excellent question. I have a 15-year-old son who I do not allow to play first shooter games, but I think we don't really know.
I think that's a really good point. You know, a lot of... It's a little bit of a sleight of hand. There's a mass shooting or any kind of shooting, and those who don't want gun reform will point to violent video games, mental illness, anything but guns as part of the problem because they don't want to regulate guns. So I don't think that means we don't have a problem with mental illness and servicing mental illness better in this country. I don't think violent video games or movies are particularly helpful, cultural reality when we have such easy access to guns. But like Shannon said, other countries have even more violent video games and even more severe mental illness issues than we do, and they just don't have the kind of access to guns. If you have a teenage son, 75% of suicides of white boys under the age of 18 are committed with a gun that is found, it's not their gun, it's found loaded and unsecured of a family member or a friend. So, you know, there is a desensitization, and when you couple that with impulsive acts and access to guns, you have a problem. But because we have the situation we do without comprehensive gun reform, you have to be vigilant. And I think that's the only answer that we have, you know?
Thanks.
Yeah.
Thank you for both of you for what you're doing on this issue. I recently attended an organizing meeting for moms in Berkeley and Oakland. They were trying to get a new group started, and I was the only male there, and I was told there is a dad's group that's affiliated, and I talked to John Phillip in Brooklyn a couple days ago. But my question has to do with elders and the role of elders. 10,000 people every day turn 65. There's 41 million people over 65 in the United States. These are folks that have a lot of time on their hand, many of them looking for meaning and purpose in life after work and their families are raised. They don't have kids at home anymore. And they're ideal candidates, it seems to me, for real activism in this area. And many of us come from the 60s. The Berkeley group that I was with, these were activists, had been around for a while. And so my second question is, first of all, is there a role for elders in this
elders
movement?
Elders demand action. You ready?
Yeah. is there a role for elders in this movement? And I don't know that we need to start a new group. I'm just wondering with moms and so on, if you take advantage of the opportunity that elders present. And then the second question related is there a role also in the movement for nonviolent direct action? I'm talking about the kinds of things were used in the civil rights movement to really bring to the fore the issues. And I can imagine, you talk about strollers, what about, wheelchairs and walkers in the legislatures and directly in front of Wayne LaPierre's house? I mean, is it time for some nonviolent direct action?
Yeah. Be careful over there.
Yeah. So what do you think of either of those issues?
I mean, wow. Caitlin, where's Caitlin?
I'm waiting in line.
Caitlin's our chapter leader, so you can talk to her about wheelchair jams. But absolutely, there's a role for, I don't know if I should call them elders, but, baby boomers for sure. And this, I was at an event in South Carolina, and it was a mom's house party, and an entire bus of people from a local retirement home got off. An entire bus. Like, this chapter leader was so smart. She was recruiting at retirement homes. So, and they were thrilled. They wanted to be involved. And absolutely, again, it's called Moms Demand Action because I felt strongly that mothers and women needed a voice in this issue. But like Mothers Against Drunk Driving, we welcome all caring Americans of all ages. And there's nothing more than I'd like to see you in a Moms Demand Action t-shirt with your wheelchair or your
walker.
Whatever. Yeah. So let's make that happen.
What about direct action?
I mean, I think, that's something that each chapter can talk about and decide what's effective in their community. There are organizations that definitely do more of that kind of work. I mean, the Brady campaign has been having what they call die-ins in New York City. So every group has sort of a different strategy.
Hi, my name's Ken, and I am very pleased. I feel like I've met you now, and I want to commend you on what you're doing. And I feel that you two gals are incredibly brave taking on what you're taking on. So thank you. My question for you is, I get up in the morning every day and I read the newspaper. I read a couple of them. And a lot of what I see in the newspaper is sensationalism. And I see a lot in the papers about shootings. And I think it sells papers. But what I'm curious about is we see a lot going on in the inner cities where there's a lot of minorities and people that are poor, and there's a lot of gangs, and there's a lot of violence.
Yeah.
And this is what we read about a lot in our papers. And when I see that and when I think about it, I also in my mind kind of feel like we've had this gun society for so long that there's like all these guns that are floating around out there. And so the question is, what do we do about all these guns that are just in the society already. There are so many of them that you can pass a lot of laws and it may improve it, but I think it's impossible to control what's already there running around. And so that's my question.
I have a few things to say about that, if that's okay. So I think one of the difficulties of this issue is that there's a complexity around different types of gun violence. So actually, suicide is a tremendous part of the problem. 22,000 of the 33,000 deaths every year are suicide. Only about 10 or 11,000 are homicide. A lot of those are domestic violence or urban impacted communities. And then there's a fair number of unintentional shootings. So when you're looking at the problem of gun violence, you actually need to nuance what you understand about the solutions. There are background check laws that can have an impact on trafficking of illegal guns into urban communities and also keep guns out of hands of people who have mental illness and might harm themselves. But there's other types of solutions that, you know, you started this by talking about urban communities. You know, in urban communities, there are approaches, partly policy, but there's also grassroots approaches, like the moms come to this from the ground. In these communities, there are groups of people who are successfully, I mean, I don't know how many of you have paid attention to Richmond, but Richmond, California had a serious gun violence problem, and they adopted a new program, ONS, which basically approached gun violence in Richmond holistically on the ground. And in the last several years, gun violence in Richmond dropped by 70%. So what that tells you is that in different places, you need to take different approaches. You know, what the moms are doing, what policy can do, corporate approach, those can address certain aspects of it. But if you really need to look at the problem holistically, you have to scratch under the surface. So I think you make a good point. We do have a lot of guns, and they're going to have to be, it's going to have to be a multifaceted, complex approach, or the problem won't go away.
There are 300 million guns in this country. So the goal is to keep those guns out of the hands of dangerous people. And that's why we're passing these laws, because that would do that. You know, when background checks were originally passed, you know, licensed dealers have to perform a background check. There was really no internet. No one had the idea that you would sell guns online. And so now flash forward to 2016 and at gun shows and online, you can get guns without a background check. No questions asked. So that is the problem that we are trying to solve. And in other countries that have a lot of guns, that have strong gun laws, they do not have the gun violence that we have.
Thank you very much.
It's a big question you asked. Okay, this is our last question. So we're going to take this one question and then we're going to wind up. I know they're going to have the Minerva students in the boardroom for those that want to join that conversation. And Shannon and I will hang around for a few minutes if you have other questions. Yeah.
Hi, Robin. Hi. Shannon. You're both among my heroes, and thank you so much for your leadership on this issue. My question is connected with the something you just brought up and what the last gentleman kind of danced around a little bit. I do a lot of my work in urban communities, and I've seen a bullet hole in a two-year-old's forehead, and he was lying in a casket buried in his mom's arms. They were both shot dead. So I see the devastation in those communities firsthand, and so often I see we're having parallel conversations, all white audiences, all black audiences. What's your vision for integrating more of the will we all have to do something serious about this issue as an integrated, you know, moms together?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Together?
Yeah, I mean, that is a priority for us, and it has been since the very beginning. I mean, this is obviously a different audience than when we're, you know, for example, we're at the State House right now in Mississippi, and we have an amazing chapter there, or when we're in Chicago. And so I don't think we're there yet, but I think that's an incredibly important part of this, and partnering with groups that already exist in those areas. And we've done that. I mean, something that's coming up is called Wear Orange. It's every June 2nd. It's the National Gun Violence Prevention Day. It was actually started when Hydea Pendleton was shot and killed in Chicago just days after that she marched in the president's inauguration. And her friends got together and started something called Wear Orange, because hunters wear orange in order to tell other hunters, don't shoot me. And we helped, you know, start that in Chicago with them and take that national and really promote their message with them as the spokespeople and how gun violence has impacted Chicago so horrifically. And I do think those are incredibly important discussions. And, you know, we're only 3.5 years old. That's the end goal.
And yeah, and I would just add, we just came out with a report on urban gun violence, which both elaborates the policy approaches, but also lifts up the community-based approaches, mostly intervention programs that are having tremendous success across the country. I think part of what we can do better, all of us who work on this issue, is to be educated about the approaches that aren't necessarily what we do, but that are working. I mean, there are some incredibly resourceful, engaged, committed people on the ground who are doing successful work in reducing gun violence in urban communities. We need to be able to talk about that. So if you want a copy of our report, you're welcome to...
I've seen it.
You've seen it. That is so awesome. And we intend to do more on that front, because I think something that has been missing is a willingness for those of us in the policy arena to talk about what's happening on the ground and vice versa. And we need to lift each other up better. So so we intend to do that. Thank you for your question. Okay, so Shannon gets the last word. I'm glad I don't have to answer this question. The question is, what is your 60-second, and everyone who comes here has to do this, so I'm not picking on her, what is your 60-second idea to change the world?
My idea to change the world is that we get more women in office. And I think there are a lot of synergies. So 19% of Congress, 25% of all state lawmakers are women. We are not making the policies that directly impact our communities. And it is time that we had a seat at that table. And I, you know, I'm part of Emerge America, an organization that helps people run, helps women run in the states, from everything from, you know, sheriff to mayor to state lawmaker to Congress. And I think it's incredibly important that we take, you know, kind of this infrastructure we've built at Moms and then see these women use the tools that they've learned through us in activism and fundraising and lobbying to become lawmakers. And we are seeing some really exciting things happen. The mayor of Nashville, who was just elected, is a woman, and she was a member of Moms. We have a mom running for sheriff in North Carolina. We have a mom running for state lawmaker in Indiana. So I know without a doubt that more women in positions of authority and power to make policy would change the world.
I really like that story. That's a great story. Thank you so much for being
here
tonight.
Thank you, Robin. Appreciate it.